It is Friday, February 1st, 2013. A very cold. The old groundhog is going to stay in his hole if he's smart. And we're talking with Brinch Bowden of WHAS. Quite a span of time there you were with HAS too, Brinch.
Yeah, in and out, back and forth. Yeah. Started in television.
Oh, is that right?
I had to get a job. My father had died. My mother had had a stroke. She couldn't work. So all of a sudden I had to come back from the University of the South at Sewanee, and I needed a job.
This was what year did you say? Did you say?
I think it was 1959 or so.
Mm-hmm.
Could have been 58, but I needed a flexible job, and being a studio director at WHAS Television allowed me to take night school, day school, and still work 40 hours.
And so you're 18, 19 years old at this time.
19 years old, and I was working full-time at WHAS Television, taking 12 hours at University of Louisville, and singing in two different choirs, and substituting occasionally as a Jewish cantor at the local temple. So I would wake up and not know where I was half the time because.
Now, what qualified you for a job as a studio director, WHAS?
Absolutely nothing.
How did that happen?
They were hiring. Well, Dave Jones, who was a television director and a real good friend of mine, said they were hiring, but said you probably wouldn't like it. But
how did you know Dave?
Dave was director of the Motet Singers, right, which is a group we sang as teenagers.
So
we were singing. He was discouraging about that, but I applied anyway and got in with about four or five other guys. They had an exodus of people in this. I got lucky and was accepted, and I had no experience in that. But
what did a studio director do?
Well, it put up sets, lit the sets, gave cues, arrange commercials. It was a lot of little things that...
It'd be interesting, though.
It was fun.
Because it changed all the time.
Well, yeah, and the thing was, that was back before the days of videotape. It was live.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing was on tape until a couple of years later.
This was still in the studios.
Still in the studio on top of the Courier Journal building.
Sixth
the oddest place in the world for a TV studio. But, yeah, you learned on the fly because there weren't any take twos. I mean, you did it right. And sometimes we had some hilarious disasters.
Tell me about
throwing food up. I can remember there was a kid, I think his name was Lee Dean, who did commercials for some ice cream company or whatever, and he was supposed to have a dish of ice cream for a close-up shot, and I realized at the end I'd forgotten to get the ice cream. At the end of the commercial, I scooped up a couple of weenie-looking pieces of ice cream and slid, and when they went to the camera, the close-up, I slid this disgusting-looking bowl of white stuff in at the last minute, and it was embarrassing. I was hiding behind the guy reaching up. I could bore you with about 20 more tales of live TV, but that's not what we're about.
Who was working there? Well, we talked about both. We talked about really HAS and the Bingham family and all that. Who was working there at the time? Do you remember any names?
Oh, I remember a lot of names, the people I work with. I still keep in touch with Steve Richards, one of my fellow floor directors, studio directors. He lives in San Diego now, had a successful career as a news producer. And, of course, the Bingham family, which will come up in a lot of this narrative because it was my first experience meeting them, and they were a terrific family, often maligned, generally by people who didn't know what they were talking about, but they were involved in that. They were uninvolved. In other words, they hired the best people they possibly could to do the jobs, from the lowliest floor director to the people in the newspaper and stuff like that. And hopefully they did their jobs, and the Binghams never meddled.
So they didn't meddle. It didn't dictate policy?
They didn't dictate policy. As a matter of fact, I can remember. Well, let me say this. The Binghams were probably the only people I've ever met in the world of television, radio, and journalism, who actually believed in journalism ethics. I can remember the time where Barry was hunting with his buddies down in southwest Jefferson County and somehow wandered in Bernheim Forest and shot Bambi. And there was a feeling amongst people in the Bingham Enterprises that they should bury this story somewhere because, you know, here he is, the heir apparent to the throne. He's known as a progressive kind of guy, and here he is going into a game preserve and killing a deer. But the Binghams insisted that it appear on page one because they felt that they weren't going to do anything resembling a cover-up. People make mistakes. They take responsibility for their actions. Now, can you imagine that happening today?
Mercy.
Not at all. I can't imagine.
You've got a lot of respect for them.
Tremendous respect for them. You know, they were human beings. They had their frailties and made their mistakes like everybody else. But they were true gentlemen and women in every sense of the word and performed that way in the way they managed the stations and the newspaper.
That's great. So you were studio director.
I was a studio director then.
Shoving things around,
then,
putting ice cream in front of people.
Yeah,
and then that progressed.
Then I became stage manager, which meant that the guys who I work with are now working for me. That was a little awkward at first. And
sure.
Then they took me out of the hands-on business and made me director of continuity operations because I had an English degree.
What does that mean?
I never was sure. I'm really assistant to the program director, in which you know we.
Of television
make changes.
Or radio?
This was still television.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a pretty easy job, to be honest with you, because I had a lot of people who worked for me and with me who were thorough professionals. And then came what I refer to as the call.
Uh-huh.
I got a message that my presence was wanted in Barry Bingham Jr.'s office.
Ooh.
And I thought I'd seen him and said hello to him. I had no idea what this was about. And so I was a little antsy about it. I went down and sat, and Barry was very affable. He was one of those people who did not wait for you to complete a sentence. He would complete it for you. He was one of those people who was anxious to get on with it. But it was interesting conversation in that I came from not knowing anything and suddenly finding out that they had applied for the last full power FM station frequency, and it was going to be all classical based on what Barry had heard in Washington when he was with NBC, WGMS, I think is what it was called then. And since I was the only one who had a degree in music history as well as English, that I was the only one in the entire building qualified to be the program director of this station.
Now, when was this? What year was that?
You know, I wish I could tell you. It was somewhere in the early to mid-60s, but you'd have to research that. I can't remember exactly. It was all a fog then. We had children.
Still in
the old building, and we had to hire a couple of capable people to help actually put together the programs, an announcer and all that kind of stuff, a salesperson. And it was Barry's dream. He really wanted to have something in Louisville that was a commercial station that played only classical music. I think what happened was that once I got over my shock, we put this thing together. What happened was that
you're still a young guy here.
I'm still a young guy, but I knew the music end of it, and that wasn't a big problem. What happened was a lot of friends of Barry's promised him that since it's such a wonderful idea, that they would support it by buying advertising. Most of them didn't do it, which meant that over the 9 years of what we called FMWHS, we lost about $1 million. Of Barry's money.
Oh, my goodness.
The one funny story I can remember from that is there's a day we went on the air. It was like 1 o'clock in the morning. We had everyone on the staff there, the engineers. Barry was there. And it was an automated station, so we had like 8 to 10 tape recorders.
Now, that was pretty rare.
That was rare back in those days. But it was all designed to not have a constant flow of announcers, disc jockeys, whatever you want to call them. So we had 6 reels full of music, commercials, public service announcements, and the announcer track, which I believe you may have done one or two yourself.
Had to get an education.
Well, a lot of people did. And came the wonderful moment when the chief engineer counted down 10, 9, blah, 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 and wanted to hit the button to start the whole thing. Every tape machine started at once.
Oh.
We had Mozart, Beethoven, Bach, commercials, public service, and announcer track that ran uninhibited through everything. So it was probably a harbinger of what the future of that station was going to be.
Do you remember how Barry reacted to that?
Shock. I mean, we're all shocked.
Yeah.
And, of course, some of the engineers were poking buttons trying to figure out what to do. And, of course, by that time, chaos had intervened and won the day. Finally, had to stop and recue it, and they figured out what went wrong. And second time he tried hitting the button. We went on the air with the right introduction and the right music, but it's such a build up. You can imagine months and months of build up to this wonderful moment where Barry's dream was going to come to fruition, and he hits the button, and it's, you know, the towers of Babel, right? And blah, 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 all the way.
It's a nightmare.
It was a nightmare, but and that went on for about, you know, we had that station. It was a pretty well run station from a programming standpoint, but we just couldn't sell it.
Yeah.
There were people who were interested. And you have to remember, FM back in those days was not the big deal it was today. There were some cars, some GE, General Motors cars, that had FM as a standard feature, but for the most part, it was an AM world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So,
who were some of the people involved in that, and in the programming and the engineering?
Well,
and,
my two programmers were Bill and Irene Underwood, who were both very, very good at what they did. We'd all get into arguments because they were such purists that we were trying to also sell things. And when I suggested a program of lighter music or excerpts from a certain symphony plus another thing, excerpt from, and mix and match those things, they had a cowl. They thought that was breaking the code. So we had a couple of run-ins like that, but they were good people, and they came up with some good programming ideas, and of course did all the grunt work, which is to make sure we didn't repeat ourselves constantly.
Did you have to transcribe the music to tape? Did they have to do that?
Yeah, we did. That was one of the things that we did during the build-up. We had to take these records and dub them to tape, real tape, so that they would play. And that took a long, long time. And we had to, before that, we all had to listen to them and time them, because we, if you
schedule, your automated system, yeah.
The automated system, and we had to do all of that. It was. I can't remember how many months it took, but it took a long, long time. And except for that abortive little start where everything ran at once, it was well done. We had a chance to interview varying guests of classical music fame, composer Morton Gould, Vladimir Ashkenazy, who was regarded as one of the great pianists of his day, Janet Baker. I remember Janet Baker, who was the leading mezzo-soprano of her day, a British woman who came in. And the only thing I remember about the lady is she was wonderful, but she had bad breath. And I'm sitting here like I'm sitting across from you, and I'm trying really hard to be polite and respectful and ask good questions. And all I can think of is, what did you have for lunch, lady?
Wow. Who were the engineers who put all that together?
Larry Basinger was the head of the engineering crew. Roger Taylor is another name I remember who came on. They're both really, really good. And you're dealing, of course, with union engineers at that point.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember coming from television, some of those guys could be not too cooperative if they were in a bad mood. But Larry and Roger did things that...
they were young guys.
And they wanted the thing to succeed, primarily because, not because of how they respected me or didn't, but pretty much because Barry Jr. wanted it. And they all respected the Binghams, I think.
That's great.
Down to every person who worked for them, I think.
Hmm. Very good. So that, and you had to see that transferred from the Courier General building over to the building at 6th and Chestnut.
Eventually we move at 7th floor to, actually 5th, 6th, and 7th. I remember the 7th floor because that's where the TV studio was, and it was kind of a strange thing getting big props in and out, but we eventually moved up the block, down the block, whatever you want to call it, to Chestnut Street, and we had, of course, everything converted. We had to move everything electronically, all the music, etc. And then, shortly after that, it was deemed by management, I mean under management, despite what Barry wanted, that the classical music format was not going to make any money. There wasn't any possibility of it. And I can remember walking through the halls a lot, and they knew I was program director of FMWHS, which was sucking money out of the entire corporate system, which I guess they translated as, I didn't get a raise this year, and that guy's the reason. So we'd get dirty looks and sometimes some comments, and we would say, well, talk to Barry about it. Well, eventually the people Barry hired to run the radio stations talked him into converting that format to all news. Again, this was Barry being way ahead of the curve, because now in all news station, talk radio, et cetera, everybody knows what those entities are. But back those days, in all news stations, you wouldn't find them except New York and Chicago. Unfortunately, we ended up in the same kind of problem we did with classical music, is that because it was so new, people didn't believe in it, and they wouldn't buy commercial time in it. So we ended up, after a year of WNNS, Barry Fowley was convinced that his dream of all classical music and all news, both of which are wonderful ideas, had to be abandoned in the for the sake of profitability, and thus was born WAMZ, which is the leading country music station, leading along with WHAS, the two leading stations still in the market. But it was still automated. All the news station was automated. We just took off the music, and we gave that to University of Louisville, and we gave them Bill Underwood to go along with it. That was part of the deal. And
is
Barry
he still
didn't.
With WUOL? Or
I think he and Irene have retired down in Florida. I think the last time I heard about them, they were down there. I hope they're both alive and well and enjoying things. But he went over with the music library to WUOL, and WUOL has carried that torch admirably well through difficult times. But it was Barry's insistence. Anytime someone listens to good music these days on that station, it's now a public station, of course, they have Barry to thank for that, because he insisted that even though it wasn't viable commercially, that the community deserved a classical station as well as the library station. So for a while we had two stations who essentially competed for the same audience, but very few cities in the country of our size had something like that. So he was determined to do that, and so we shifted that. And as I said, WAMZ, to begin with, was all automated. We recorded announcers. It worked the same way. It's just we had to change the format and the logs to reflect certain things. And I have the honor, I think, or the consider how much money we lost, the black mark of having put on the air three separate stations, FM stations.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Huh? And only one of them made money, but the other two went on the air.
Well, you're still going strong. AMZ still going strong. I'm just trying to pick a picture. I think Larry Basinger told me that Coyote Calhoun, when they hired him to start the country music, at first was still trying to work with the automated system. I just can't imagine Coyote Calhoun in an automated system. And
well, we couldn't think of Coyote Calhoun in country music. It was back in the day. He was
right.
A rock.
That's
so,
right,
but
yeah.
They thought he was doing. He was a lot younger then, so he was, and was anxious to make this work. And at that point, it became necessary, inevitable that the country music station have its own program director. So I went into operations for both the FM station and WHAS.
Which involved what?
Oh, wow. Producing derby coverage, producing a lot of remote events, writing copy, being in charge of the getting the commercials on the air, so to speak. It was a busy job.
Yeah, all the behind the scenes stuff.
All the behind the scenes stuff. Yeah, and that was fine with me. It was, had several children at that point, and needed a job. So I kind of acclimated myself to the job. But I think the interesting thing about all of that period was that if you look what happened to radio and television was being attacked by cable TV, completely unregulated cable TV. And so WHAS television managed to thrive under Barry's leadership and become a very fine television station, which it still is. AM radio, which was way back in the day before my day, live music, had to convert to almost all of them converted to music stations, except WHAS, which slowly became an all-talk station, and very successful. A lot of the radio stations back in the day, which got big ratings, have disappeared.
Yeah.
And then, of course, through the metamorphosis of classical music to news to country music, WAMZ became the ratings leader in the FM station. So under Barry's leadership, everything prospered. And when the breakup came and all the books came out and the comments came out, it made those of us who really worked directly with Barry absolutely furious because they gave him credit for nothing. And in fact, he turned what could have been a disaster on the AM side into profitability. Also on FM, the television station was still doing well, and the newspaper was surviving. They all sold for prices that people didn't think they would get, all because of his leadership. I can remember one thing that is kind of interesting. Back in the late 80s, I can't put a date on it, we were all sitting around talking about the future of broadcasting. You know, broadcasting people do that. And Barry said, someday, in the near future, newspapers are going to really be in trouble because there's going to be going to come a time when people are going to get their news on their computer. And remember, this is the late 80s.
Right.
And we're looking at each other like, what's he talking about? Is he smoking something funny or what?
Yeah.
And he explained it. But at the time, in Louisville, Kentucky, in the late 80s, we had no idea what he's talking. We thought he'd gone off the deep end. And it turned out, of course, he was ahead of the curve in that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So when people talk about the Binghams, hopefully they remember that family as one who cared about the community and left their imprint in a lot of different ways. But Barry Jr. in particular was way ahead of people in terms of the media in general. And his actions were all turned out to be, for the most part, good decisions, which ended in profitability for the company. And when I hear today's people talk anything negative about the Bingham family, I want to say, you weren't there.
Yeah.
I was there. I saw the people act as people who cared about the community and were good business people at the same time in a difficult era. So,
sounds like his genius was anticipating things and finding good people who knew how to do things and
exactly.
Staying out of their way.
Exactly. And there were some mistakes made. When you hire people, you think of the best people to do the job, and then you have a hands-off attitude toward them. Sometimes they screw up. I mean, they do. And he hired a couple of people who just really didn't work out for various reasons, which I won't mention names or circumstances. But he took the blame for that, too, and went on and got people to replace them who were better people.
And let's go here.
All right. Fire away.
Okay, so we talked about the Bingham family and Barry especially. But you're at WHAS, well, AM, your operations director.
Correct.
And that means you wear a lot of hats, including doing things behind the scenes that make the on-the-air things work well.
That's correct.
Equipment changed a lot during that time, didn't it, from the time you were there?
It is. Luckily, we had an engineering department that really did a good job.
You mentioned Larry Basinger, who else was involved.
Charlie Strickland, was our chief engineer on the FM side, is a quiet, knowledgeable guy who solved problems that we thought were unsolvable. And those are the names that stick out the most, though a lot of good people worked hard. I didn't have too much direct contact with salespeople. There was always, because I was strictly on the programming side. And essentially,
your responsibility was to get the commercials produced.
Yeah, get the commercials produced. And we had, in the time, I think you were there during a lot of the time, where we had one of the most creative staffs. People like Gary Burbank started there,
yeah.
And then John Polk, Jim Ferguson, all the production directors had were superb and did.
Because that was an era when they had gone from where an engineer had to do everything and an announcer sat in a booth, where a guy like a John Polk or Jim Ferguson would go into a studio
and produce all this stuff.
You'd copy and they'd put it all together.
And it was particularly under Mike Cresham and Jim Topmiller, two of the best station managers I work for. They are also, in addition to making money for the company, which was their main job, wanted to win awards.
Oh, yeah.
And we had a staff that we would take an hour and a half producing one 30-second commercial to get it right. Those were the days where dialogue commercials, which now are too prevalent on the air, were coming in, and I would write them, and we get a lot of variety of voices. Bill Cody, who's now down in Nashville, And John Polk was terrific at producing him, and very impatient. He would throw things a lot, but that's that was
the
part of his
gig.
That was the day of the job. He would salespeople would come in, wonder what happened to commercial, and he would order them out rudely.
Remember any of the salespeople who were around then?
You know, the one name that sticks in mind is Jerry Solomon, who was for sales in sales. He was our lone salesperson for FM WHS for a while, just continued. Eventually went to AMZ.
I didn't realize he'd come in that capacity.
Yeah, he had done that. A lot of names. I'm afraid to mention
Kurt Smith
a name. Kurt. I'm afraid to mention too many names. I'm going to leave out somebody. He's going to be mad at me. And all those years I was there.
But Topmiller, I think, was the problem. It was Bob Shear was there.
Oh. Bob Shear was there.
He became the station manager. Would you work under him as a station manager?
Yeah, I worked under all three. All three guys, as operation director, and they were all really good.
Did you work some with Hugh Barr?
A little bit. He was station manager when I was program director of FM WHS and NNS. But then he was. I worked a little bit more directly with his successors. I think they all had their willingness to do things that would also would be the right thing to do as well as the money-making thing to do. And sometimes the program directors and sales managers don't drink the same water. I mean, sometimes they disagree with each other. Yeah. I think they were all liked. I had some wonderful people working for me, Helen Huber and Ann
Hubbs.
We also created a position. I had some interesting people work there. I can tell you this story because it shows some very interesting things. In the 70s, there was a lot of pressure nationally on equal opportunity. And one day I looked around the halls of WHS. This was early on after being ops director. And I saw very few African Americans, like two, on the radio side. And I knew that if we didn't increase that and get capable people, that sooner or later the feds were going to notice that. And it was interesting that not a lot of people were on top of that at that point. Coincidentally with that, well, actually I went to Mike Crush, his manager then, and said, we really need to create a position, a ground-level position. We can start working African-Americans into the workforce, because if we don't, someone's going to make us do it, we'll end up having the wrong people. At the same time, one good thing about my job as operations director is that I could brown bag my lunch, and Helen and Ann would do a lot of the work, and I would just take off at lunchtime, walk three blocks down to the YMCA. And I had my pattern pretty well set. I'd go in the weight room Monday, Wednesday, and Friday and play basketball Tuesday and Thursday. And I can remember one day I was playing ball, went up for a rebound, and ended up flat on my back. And there grinning at me was a miniature Charles Barkley. He was like 5'9 and 200 pounds, black dude, and he's helped me up with a big smile on his face. And at that point, I was having none of that nicety, because that wasn't the way you played basketball in the YMCA. It was the old joke, you know, I went to a fight and a basketball game broke out. So the next time down the floor, he came out of the rebound until I knocked him down. And we did this for a while, and pretty soon we exchanged names. I told him I was Brench Bowden, worked for WHS, and he said, my name's Buster Coleman. I came to find out later that they called him Buster. His real name was Lewis. He became the Reverend Lewis Coleman.
Is that right?
And so in the process of conversing through the next year or so, he was working as assistant director for the Urban League, and I was trying to find some way to get qualified people into WHS and WAMZ, and we discovered we had the same goal. So we did create, under Mike Crushing a position to help Helen and Ann in the continuity department, traffic continuity department. And Buster sent me some applicants. Unfortunately, they were neat, well-spoken, but in terms of written parts, and this was a job that requires great specificity of detail, I didn't find anybody at that particular time. We did hire somebody, created the position. We had a succession of very successful people, a couple Lewis sent over, Hazel Miller, may some people remember her with Look What We Can Do, Louisville, whatever that song was. We had another lady who became assistant to the station manager. So it turned out to be kind of an interesting confluence of ideas, but I'm happy that now we see an equal opportunity in all areas, but particularly in the radio area where competence is valued. And we did things, I think, the right way by getting people who were smart and could do their jobs and be promoted. So that, I think, was one of the accomplishments that I look back on my years at WHAS, and you know, I'm a little proud of that, to be honest with you.
Yeah,
it just you know, up to the day he died, Lewis and I still talked every once in a while.
He started by getting knocked out on the basketball court
and
the YMCA.
And, you know, we would argue. I mean, I would argue about education with him, and when he went out too far on the wing, like I think when he had his folks pick at Papa John's, and I said, you know, that's nothing to do with Josh Nodder. You're way out the limit. Well, and he'd come back, and I would tell him, first thing I did was give him the tip that he needs to go to assignment editors and not news directors. He was trying to get on TV and radio a lot. I said, forget the news directors, find out who the assignment editors.
So you helped him. Yeah.
So I helped him, and I'm sure there are people in Louisville who wish that I had not given him that tip because Lewis could be belligerent at times, but I think his heart was always in the right place, and I miss having him around. I'm sure some people may have different opinions, but he was a great guy. And And at least my thanks, everlasting thanks to Ann and Helen, my traffic women, for...
Helen is still there, by the way.
Is she?
Something about 40 years now.
When I walked out the door, I think she was still there. They were really good consistently with their jobs, and they covered for me nicely, and I appreciate that very much, ladies.
You mentioned covering different events. Derby was one that you produced those. WHAS Radio would go out and spend the day out there broadcasting. And, of course, not only that, but leading up to it with all the events, you had to cover all that kind of stuff, too, didn't you?
Everything back
balloon
in the day.
Race,
balloon race. Yeah,
steamboat race.
I saw the whole Derby Festival Week come with dread because we covered everything. I can remember being out on the steamboat up on the shore. I can remember covering the very first thunder over Louisville, and at the very first time, and it occurred to me then, why are we doing this? It's like covering a ping pong tournament, you know. You don't see the pictures. I mean, you can talk about the fireworks, you can talk about the airplanes, but I thought first time in my life I'm producing really boring radio, and you know, maybe people like that, I'm not sure, but the rest of the events were good, and we'd have to get out in the field and do all this kind of stuff. That, as you said, the Derby was the big deal.
And you were in the booth with
Wayne Perkey to start with, Paul Rogers, started with Cable Ledford, and then Paul Rogers, and we went on the air around 9 o'clock in the morning and ended around 6:30, 7 o'clock. It was a long day, and we had a format that's like 24 pages. I mean, the way I did it was format everything. And then I'd put in some time, some space, so if things ran long, we could cover that. I learned that after being burned a couple of times. But it was very well. Now, I think now they just kind of ad lib it, from what I hear. And that's fine. That works for some people. It didn't work for me. I really had to have... Wayne, bless his heart, was a wonderful guy to work with. I love him dearly. He's a great friend. Sometimes he would run a little long, and we'd have get somewhat warfare in the booth because I had to get certain people. We had the winning horse or something like that, or the jockey, and we had to get to that. But I think it was probably the longest live radio sporting event broadcast ever, I believe. People could make a case for the Indy 500, maybe, but we started with the very first race and ended with the very last race.
Yeah, even the one after the Derby. Yes.
Even the one after the Derby. All the interviews, the stars, and I remember Milton Metz and a few other people go out in the grandstand and get the upper crust, and we had people in the infield, which was difficult at times given the behavior. I started out covering the Derby in television. CBS had the rights, and they hired me to supervise a bunch of guys from WHS to do little cards and stuff on the roof. I was on the roof of the thing the whole time. I can remember one time when a guy named Frank Cherkinian, who is famous in broadcasting, he just died. Yeah. He had a habit of calling people names at times, and these were guys running camera who were really tough union guys from New York, and you really shouldn't mess with people like that. But he was calling them some names for doing something wrong, and they talked to the union steward, and somewhere around the fifth, sixth race, they locked the cameras down. So we had no rehearsal for the Derby until someone found an executive who was sober, which was kind of difficult at the time, and talked nicely to the union steward who hadn't opened up the cameras in time to do the Derby, the eighth race. But we didn't do the seventh race. There was no rehearsal for that particular year's Derby. So I learned the hard way about how tough it can be to spend an entire day covering the Kentucky Derby. So really, the radio was in many ways a little easier, mainly because I was in charge of it. That was that helped. Those were hard days, but good days because we had a lot of good people.
Yeah, that was one of the keys to AJS, I think, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, the people, particularly up to the time until the time Bingham sold it. Not that the people running it now are good people, but I can remember so many people. And again, I can't mention all their names because I forget somebody. But the on-air people, the technical people, the news people, they were all. All great, and it was live. It was live. I can one story from the radio days was, I won't mention the guy who did the broadcast, but evidently, early in the morning there was a traffic accident where some poor soul stepped off the curb too early, and a TARC bus ran him down. Mm. And I believe the opening line was, "Derby Day started badly for John Smith." Who stepped off the podium, was run over and killed by a TARC bus. I think that's maybe not the best way to start our Derby coverage with. We all say, what did he say? But again, live radio, live TV, those are the things that in my memory stick with me the most, the goofs and the screw-ups. And on the positive side, all the great people I had a chance to work with from the top, Barry Bingham Jr., down to every person in the office. There was a tremendous pride at WHAS, both on the FM and the AM side, in the product. I mean, everyone wanted to make money. I mean, we all knew, we had been in business for a while, we knew that was the bottom line. But there was a tremendous pride in the product we put on the air on everyone's part. And if you weren't of that mindset, you didn't last too long there. And it wasn't because someone be upset and fired you, they ended up leaving because there was just a feeling that we had some pride in the product. WHS, certainly those call letters had a ring to it that came back in history, and certainly the Bingham family, we felt, deserved the kind of product that reflected their investment in it and in the community at large. So I think that's that. As I said, I don't want to mention too many more names because I know I'm going to leave out hundreds of people that I've worked with over the years.
One would be especially Kaywood Ledford. You worked with Kaywood some?
Kaywood, yeah. Kaywood was really a knowledgeable guy, and we'd meet. Sometimes I'd have to. Guy was missing, I had to set up a basketball game or something like that. But my most interaction with Kaywood outside of television was, on my years of TV, was at the Derby.
Derby.
And I think one of the real hard parts of my job at that point was to see Kaywood getting along in age. His eyes just couldn't pick up the colors anymore and couldn't pick up the horses coming out of the gate. And he had to give that up. He loved it. He loved every part about the track. We would meet early in the morning, and we would go through some stuff. He was already with his program. He was the ultimate professional. Of course, everyone said that about Kaywood, and not adding anything that's new. But Paul Rogers came along and picked right up where Kaywood left off and did his own good job with the Derby broadcast. So yeah, there are a lot of people from outside the community and inside the community I had a chance to work with, and most of those memories are very, very good.
I talked with Charlie Strickland recently for one of these interviews, and Charlie gave you some real credit. He said French Bowden was correct. He told me once that our competitors are not other radio stations, it's television. Do you remember telling him that and what that meant?
I remember that. And that was something that we understood on the operations side. I'm not sure the sales department did. The sales people were still out trying to outsell the other radio stations. But because I'd worked in TV and knew a little bit about it, I could see, especially as cable came along, I could see the rates dropping because of competition. And so you've got a station like WHAS, which commands big ratings and therefore naturally charges more for their spots, going up. And some of the weaker television programming you could get for less than a spot on WHAS or WAMZ for that matter. And so we kind of kept pointing that out to the folks, that you really need to watch over your shoulder because the TV people are more aggressive now. They will give you free production for a TV spot, and you know, pictures are pictures. So you had to be alert about where your competition was in a lot of different areas. But Charlie was right, and he knew. He's a good example of those people who were in the background, but you knew a heck of a lot about the industry, from not just from an engineering standpoint, from a common sense standpoint. So he was right on the money.
Well, and of course, even in programming, that's true, because now everything that was on radio that HAS did then, live broadcast from places, traffic reports, weather on the spot, all television stations. They didn't do that at that time. They didn't have the capability of doing those kind of things, and now they're all doing it.
They learned, too.
Yep.
They've learned local business, local doings have a big place in TV as well as radio. And as you say, the technology is such that before it was difficult, but now you can just, you know, get a shoulder camera and go out in the field and put a mic on somebody, and you can do. They've reacted a lot better than they have. There aren't any dumb people in media today.
Can't afford to be. Anyway.
Can't afford to be, because there's always something. And now the big thing is trying to get the younger market, who have other devices stuck in their ear all the time, and radio is trying to reinvent itself. I could remember when the campaign came, less is more. So we were going to convert radio. Our radio stations were going to concentrate more on 30-second commercials as well as 60. And I'm thinking, I've heard this before. Because some things never change. They recycle themselves. The young people thought that was something new, but it really wasn't new. You're always trying to tighten up what you're doing. Because back in the days, it was just, you know, a second or two of dead air. Didn't bother anybody. But as media change, it's hard to find silence. I mean, even between elements of programming. So, yeah, everyone's getting a little smarter, and they have to be, because there's so many sources of information now that you have to hustle.
So you were there from 1959 until there was the gap. You left and then came back for a while. When did you leave?
I got a really good offer. I think it was 80s, 90s, from Levy's Lumber and Building, from Philip and Steve Levy, who still remain my favorite, two of my favorite people.
Yeah, good people.
And unfortunately, you know, they, like everyone in local business, had trouble with the competition, and there's no more Levy's anymore, which is not a good thing. So I went there, marketing director for a while, which enabled me to get back into TV, because TV, they weren't doing television at the time, and they needed to. And I got so interested in TV that I thought, well, maybe I could do everything. So my wife suggested this. Said, why don't you go to Barry Jr. and see if he'd be interested in backing an advertising agency? So I did, and he was. And we had some good years, and then recessions came along, and not so good years. And then so we just figured that time has passed. And I took the agency in-house, literally in my house. And then I got a call from Bill Gentry, who was a station manager of the whole Clear Channel group, and said, we sat down and decided that I could lower my insurance cost and help him just by copywriting and occasionally dropping some voices on tape, and comic voices, something like that.
What year was this? Do you remember what year?
Well, it would have been 12 years from last year, so that would have been about 2000, the year 2000. Mm-hmm. And that worked out quite fine. Again, a lot of people, really good people, helped.
Of course, in this time, it had transitioned from the Binghams to Clear. Were you there during that transition?
I was there. I was 1 year of the transition before I left to go to Levy's, and then from thence went there to an advertising agency. When I came back, a couple of people were still there, but things had changed.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying this in a negative way. It's just that I think the pressure today on them, as well as everyone in the media and agencies and things like that, is so intense because there is so much competition. The media continues to change, and in many ways, the more it changes, the more it stays the same. You've got still have to do the basics right, and there was just a tension there that wasn't there back in the days. I'm not really talking about the days when the Binghams owned it, because there was a feeling all the Binghams have a lot of money, they don't need to make more, but that wasn't the case. That was never the way the Binghams ran a company. They wanted to be profitable like everybody else. It was just, I think, the economy that just made things a little more tense within the offices. It wasn't, they were nice people, and I enjoyed my time there the second time around. It just wasn't as much fun.
Different building, too, of course.
Different building, but still it wasn't as much fun. I kept thinking about the days when we would go in a production studio and create a commercial that would win a Gold Louis, for example. We won so many Silver Louis, we end up tossing them in the corner somewhere.
Louis was an award put out by the Global
Advertising thing, and second place was not acceptable. I think they're probably sticking in a corner somewhere in that building. But I'd look back at those times when we'd really want to do absolutely the best, and now there's no time to do that. Yeah. I think they're so anxious to produce as many commercials to increase profitability that and I admire people who can do that and be happy with that. And I'm really not one of those people.
Yeah.
I'm really not. Though I was generally satisfied. Again, the people who were working in the production department, Dave Lee, who's currently director of production of this station, is a terrific guy, and he is not satisfied until everything is good. But I think that things just does change, and change is inevitable, and maybe it'll change back after the economy improves. I don't know.
Well, good. You mentioned early on your connection with Dave Jones and the Motet Singers. You've been very involved in the musical community in Louisville all those years.
But. Well, that's another whole story. My degree was in music history and English, but I had been singing since I was a little kid, and I knew enough about my talent so that I wasn't going to make any money at it. So I directed choirs and choruses for about 25 years, still sing some, still compose some.
What groups did you sing with and for?
Kentucky Opera, Louisville Orchestra, a whole bunch of things like that. I can remember one time, this is kind of illustrative, I was directing a choir at St. Paul Episcopal Church out on Low Road, and this is a nice, good people, middle-class church. I got a call from George Mester, he and I had become friends over and we'd already done one project together.
He's the director of that.
He's director of Louisville Orchestra at the time. It was his first time around. Mm-hmm. And said, I heard your junior choir is really good. And I said, yeah, it is pretty good. I had about 22, 23 kids. He said, I wonder if you could sing. I want your kids to sing with the Louisville Orchestra. And I said, okay. It's the last minute of a Berlioz piece. I can't remember which one it was. Maybe The Damnation of Faust or something like that. It's not important. It's 5 minutes. It's at the end of the piece, and it's in four parts, and it's in French. And I'm thinking, well, to be honest, ours was the only choir could do that. Because we had some wonderful parents who would bring their kids to rehearsal. So we ended up doing it.
Wow.
We ended up doing it. Got a better review than the adult choir. But many of these kids age like 8 through 14 from a nice middle-class church. Didn't have a lot of private music lessons. They didn't go to youth performing arts or something like that. Standing up on stage with the Louisville Orchestra singing in four parts, which is tough to get kids to do,
sure,
in French, and doing a fabulous job. I think that's one of the most proud moments I've ever had. Just proud of those kids and really proud of the parents who put up with me and my rehearsal techniques to do that. But yeah, I was able to, because I didn't depend on that for my main income, I was able to, you know, conduct and sing and make some money in various parts of the music spectrum in Louisville. Had a good time with those folks too. Fun for the Arts, wonderful organization, still is. So, and of course, the Binghams encourage that. They encourage you to give back to the community. So I didn't have any problem taking off a little bit here and there in order to do something like that. So it was, again, it all comes back to having that basic framework owned by the Binghams and their devotion to the city. And of course, when it comes to music, how many millions of dollars did they give to support the arts in Louisville? And one of the great tragedies of our age was when the family was forced to break up and divest, and the arts has recovered from it, sort of. But, you know, the idea of having the Binghams not there, to support all these things was difficult.
Yeah.
Very difficult.
Very true. Well, Brent, this has been delightful. Anything else you want to add about memories of WHAS?
Oh, if we could sit here for another couple of hours, I'm sure I could come up with some more things, some of which I couldn't say on the air. But again, it
sounds like it was a good experience.
It was a good experience, and of course, we all look back on our lives with a little. It's always a little rosier than it actually was, and I'm sure my career with WHAS had those moments too. But I guess the two things I will carry from it were the great people that I work with and my respect for the Binghams. I think I told you when we first talked about this, if there's one thing that I wanted to get on record was that most of the stuff written about Barry Jr. and the Binghams post-breakup was just plain, and here's where you would put in the bleep, because they weren't there. Mm-hmm. Maybe some on the periphery, but they weren't there. They didn't work with Barry on a daily basis. They didn't see the family and meet with them, as I was fortunate enough to do. The breakup of the Bingham family was an immeasurable loss to the city of Louisville, and I was lucky to be a part of what that family gave to Louisville, and my part in it was small, but was important to me.
And it's still going on, really, with UOL, with the radio station.
It still lives on,
yeah. It's great. Well, thanks, Brent. Appreciate it.
You're welcome, Jack.
In the future.
Thank you.